everyone. This is Sean Ennis with the MMA Torchcast for August 31st, 2007. This is our UFC 74 post-event roundtable. It's not a very big table at this point, being myself and Mike Jarflick. Mike, how's it going?
I'm hanging in there. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing all right, man. Well, let's just jump right into this thing. We've got 9 fights to cover and maybe a little bit of news here and there, if we can think of some. We'll start off with Clay Guida and Marcus Aurelio. Now, you haven't had a chance to see this one, correct?
No, I haven't.
Okay. I did get to check this one out. It wasn't a terribly impressive outing by Marcus Aurelio. I don't know whether it was the UFC jitters or, you know, what have you. Aurelio's a very experienced guy. So, you know, I don't know if that was it or if he was just not one to get it on with Clay Guida or what have you. But he couldn't take Guida down, and it turned into mostly a striking contest. And, you know, Guida's got okay boxing, but he used most of it to set up his takedowns. You know, he puts on a good pace, but the fight never really got into a rhythm. It was mostly kind of a stand-up affair. I had a 30-27 for Guida, so I have no idea how one of the judges got a 29-28 for Aurelio. I think it was pretty much, a dominating performance by Guida. He just imposed his will, you know, not wanting to get into Aurelio's guard or hit the floor or any of that. There was a brief period where he did go down, but, you know, Aurelio went for a takedown, and Guida ended up sprawling and getting in the top position and pounded away for a little bit. But, you know, nothing serious. And other than that, I mean, you know, it's your basic fight. It was fine. Guida wins by split decision. The other two judges had 30-27 for Guida as well. So, you know, I don't know what was going on there. But anyway, moving on, we've got what was actually the second fight of the night and the last fight shown on the pay-per-view card, Talis Latis and Ryan Jensen. What's your take on that one?
I thought Talis Latis looked very impressive. He had one poor fight in the UFC, and that was against Martin Kampman, but he seems to have bounced back from that and has looked great recently. And I like the armbar finish, too.
Yeah, yeah. Real good-looking armbar rolling into it like that.
Yeah, he trains with Shaolin Ribeiro, and Shaolin used that in one of his recent K-1 fights, and they're very similar grapplers. And
yeah.
I enjoy watching both of them, and they're both going to make waves out there.
Yeah, for sure. Shaolin Ribeiro, of course, being a lightweight that fights mostly in K-1 Heroes. But, yeah, I really am enjoying Latest as of late as well. I think, as you said, he had that one bad outing against Camden where he just got pretty much pounded for 3 rounds, losing that unanimous decision. But I'll tell you what, when he is getting beating, he can take a beating. He was beaten pretty much mercilessly for the entire time and, you know, never really backed down or anything. So, you know, and when he's up the game, boy, he can go. Real nice ground skills. Actually, really pretty good striking, too.
Yeah, the problem against Kampman seemed to be mostly a cardio issue as the fight got into later rounds.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with him now. You know, I know they're looking to push him, you know, with his last few fights. He had Jensen, of course, he was a late replacement for Travis Luter in this fight. But, you know, he had Pete Sell and Floyd Sword before this. Sword, of course, being out of MMA for a couple of years before coming back. And Pete Sell, you know, your recent underachiever, you know, started off promising but hasn't really done much since then. That's pretty much what you're looking at with Latis. Any final take on this one? What do you think of Jensen?
Jensen's a very mediocre fighter. He's a good wrestler, and his stand-up isn't really that impressive. I don't think he is that much of a threat for submissions on this level, but, you know, he's a decent fighter. I don't ever see him as being a top contender in the middleweight division or anything, but he's a guy that could stick around and pick up a few wins.
Yeah. Yeah, Jensen seemed like a guy that could put up a good, a pretty decent fight as far as pace and all that is concerned. You know, never really was tentative at all in the fight, which goes to his credit, I think, at least for getting another UFC fight. So we'll kind of have to see where that goes. But, pretty decent fight. Good showing by Latus. Really nice rolling on bar that he got out of there. So that was fun to watch. Next, of course, we have Frank Mir and Tony Hardong. What was your take on this one?
Frank Mir came out looking like the old Frank Mir from back in 2001, 2002 time frame. He looked very good, and really can't fault anything on his performance. Now, he's going up against Anthony Hardong, who is not the greatest guy when it comes to takedown defense.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah, he did a very nice job of sprawling to his back.
Yeah, he's pretty much helped Mir in his cause.
Yeah, and I see Mir's biggest problem in MMA and this time frame being the fact that he may not be able to take someone down. And is he going to have the cardio to do that?
Yeah. And it's, ironically, that's always been the question with Mir is, I was mentioning in Monday's column, he's only been out of the first round, twice since he's been in the UFC, since 2001. Once against Wes Sims, where they both gassed out in the second round, and he ended up winning on strikes. And once against Dan Christensen, where he won a fairly lackluster decision. But Mir has always been a quick finisher, looking to submit guys within a minute and a half, So that's, I think you're right. I think that's the question now is if he fights somebody with decent takedown defense, even decent takedown defense, what's he going to do? Even if he fights Tim Sylvia again, who he obviously has an advantage of over on the ground, would he be able to get Tim Sylvia to the ground? I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. What do you think about Frank Mir's future?
Frank Mir is going to do well whenever he can take someone down and whenever he can work from the top. There's no one more dangerous out there than Frank Mir when it comes to hitting submissions from the top.
Yeah, very true.
He's very powerful, but if you get him up against a guy that got a good sprawl, he's going to have trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, the problem with him against the guy with takedown defense, at least, as history has indicated, is that, like you said, he'll gas out after, four or five takedown attempts, and he'll do that in the first round. And after that, if the guy still has any fight left in him, he can knock him out, so... that's the big question mark with Frank Mir. So I kind of wonder what they're going to do with him next. I noticed, and I don't know maybe it was just me. I'll have to rewatch the fight again. The fight was only a minute and 17 seconds long, and he seemed a little bit. Not completely out of breath, but a little bit out of breath when he was during the post fight interview.
Yeah, he did, and he was gassed very quickly before the Brandon Barra fight. It was like 30 seconds in it. He was breathing heavy.
Yeah. So it's classic Frank Mir. He says he's back, and, if he's back to the way he was, then cardio is still an issue, so we'll have to see how that goes. Next fight had a controversial ending with Babalu Sobral and David Heath. What was your take on this one?
Babalu looked very good in the fight. David Heath looked pretty pitiful. He didn't even seem to have anything that he did against Lyoto Machida. And he just put on a very poor performance, and Babalu capitalized on it. His stand-up looked good. He used his strikes to set up a takedown, and he had a lot of very good striking on the ground. The anaconda choke at the end was beautiful, except for the fact that he decided to hold it a little bit longer than anyone would have liked to have seen.
Yeah. And if you didn't see the fight, what happened was, as Mike mentioned, we had the anaconda choke, which was really, really nicely done. Used the gator roll into the anaconda choke from the guillotine. And after he tapped out, Babalu looked at the ref and cinched that choke in tighter for a few more seconds until Heath went out and then let go of it. So, and at this point, the fight was a bloodbath. You know, Heath bled all over the place. Once the fight went to the ground, Fabulous opened up a cut on his forehead. You know, pounded him a little bit, and slipped that guillotine on there to get the anaconda choke. And you know, he was bleeding like crazy. And you know, which I think he made it that much worse, or at least it made it look that much worse when he's choking a guy out that's already tapped. You know. And then talking in the post-fight about teaching him a lesson, and you know, he's shooting himself in the foot here, because this is a guy who is really well-liked by the fans, got a good reception, you know, before the fight, and has always been, you know, popular among fans, and now he does something like this, and it just doesn't speak well of him.
Yeah, it has seemed lately like Bobaloo's falling apart. There was the incident, I believe, down in Florida, where
yep.
he was arrested for getting into a fight with a bouncer.
Yeah.
And it's just, you have to question, hey, what's going on with this guy?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely something to question. I don't know, you know, whether he's got some personal stuff going on. Obviously, there's something, you know, with getting arrested and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, this is, you know, the irony is, this is the kind of Bobaloo that we enjoy seeing in the cage. Because, as you said, he looked really good throughout the fight. He set up his takedowns well with the strikes. I really expected more out of David Heath, honestly. I picked him to win the fight. I think maybe more because Bobaloo was in kind of a funk, you know, than because Heath was doing so well. Because I expected Heath to come out angry after his fight with Lyoto Machida. I don't know, did you see that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, where he never really got a hold of him and was just frustrated the entire fight, you know, with Machida being so elusive. With his style, but I expected Heath to just come out and really take it to Bobaloo, and he never was really able to get a hold of him. You know, and he had his opportunities on the feet to take advantage of you know, a striking advantage that a lot of people thought he had, but he never was really able to capitalize on anything.
Yeah, well, the game plan against Bobaloo is to let Bobaloo fight aggressive.
Yeah, exactly.
Jason Lambert did that, and he was gassed 4 minutes into the first round.
Yep.
Chuck Liddell has had a lot of success doing that, and he was able to knock out Bobaloo twice off mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you look at the Chuck Liddell fight, you know, obviously it's Liddell punching, but, you know, he knocked him out moving backwards. You know?
Yeah, it was all counter punching.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the thing with Bobaloo, and really the first round was mostly tentative by Bobaloo, and that should have been Heath's, you know, time to capitalize and go after him, because Bobaloo will fight back, and that's when he's vulnerable. But, you know, Heath never really seemed to take any opportunities, which was ironic, you know, considering the pre-fight talk and all that stuff. I was really expecting a more aggressive David Heath, but we never really got to see that. So, and what's your take on the whole ending? I know we've got, I mean, I was saying that he should be at least suspended from the UFC. I know the NSAC has withheld half of his purse, which is $25,000. 25 is half of his purse. So, I mean, what's your take? Should they punish him? Should they let him back in? What should they do with Bobaloo at this point?
I think a 6-month suspension would be sufficient here. And that would have to be an athletic commission suspension. I really don't like the idea of the UFC going out on their own and suspending people, because it's not really a punishment stance. A lot of the guys can go elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I would like to see, I'd kind of like to see it from both. You know, the NSAC obviously can suspend him and he can't fight anywhere, as you say. But the UFC, I think, should also take that initiative. Maybe suspend him for a little bit longer from the UFC itself. You know, after his suspension's up with the NSAC, he could still fight, you know, wherever, but the UFC will say, all right, you know, maybe you can't come back until this long or what have you. Because at this point, I think they need to send a message, you know. And it should be easy to do with Bobaloo. He's a guy who is a big enough name that people are going to know he's gone, but at the same time, he's not really in the upper tier of the light heavyweight division right now, given his recent title loss.
Yeah, he's not a guy that's going to be getting a shot at a title anytime soon, so they
right.
really don't need him around.
Right.
So I think they may feel that they can use him to send a message to the other fighters.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think it would be it's a tough thing to set a precedent that says, you know, well, you may get in trouble with the commission, but we'll bring you back in after your suspension's over. You know, I just don't know if you can do that. I mean, obviously you can, you know, with the increased scrutiny that the UFC is getting now and is going to get later, as more and more mainstream outlets begin covering UFC more regularly, they're gonna want to do this before people start calling them on it. You know, I mean, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah, I have a feeling that in the very near future that UFC is going to feel the need to serve their own suspension.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if they want to be the so-called NFL of mixed martial arts, you know, then follow that model as far as disciplining fighters, you know, be it with behavior incidences like this one or with drug violations, you know, whatever the position is on steroids or on recreational drugs, you know, like I said, the increased scrutiny is going to cause more people to question this, and if you get in the public on the bad side of the public, you know, it's never a good thing. So,
getting on the bad side of the media is a whole lot worse because because they control the public.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, getting on the bad side of the public through the media, which is really the easiest way to get on the bad side of the public, is getting on the bad side of the media. You know, if you cross the guys on ESPN, Stephen A. Smith gets on the air and starts hollering about you, you know, you might as well forget about it. But anyway, all that aside, what's that?
People listen to him?
I guess maybe not Stephen A. Smith, but Mike Wilbon, perhaps. They might listen to Mike. Good point. But moving on, we've got our first main card fight of the evening with a big upset here. Patrick Cote and Kendall Grove. What do you think about this one here?
Well, the guys I had over my place for the pay-per-view, we were discussing that, hey, Patrick Cote has a good chance of winning this thing. And we have all seen the Kendall Grove, Hector Ramirez fight and saw him pretty much gets knocked out in about a minute's time by Ramirez, and you know, that's still stuck in our minds, and could see Cote winning it. We didn't think it would happen because we all thought that Kendall Grove is a different fighter now, but it seems like his chance is questionable.
Yeah, he got the punch he got hit with, you know, on the side of the head. That is, it's the same kind of shot that took out George St. Pierre by Matt Serra. So it's, to me, it's kind of hard to judge a guy's chin by that. But like you say, there was the Hector Ramirez fight where he went down like a sack of, ton of bricks. So there is that question, I think, still with Kendall Grove. What surprised me in this fight was that he really let Cote dictate where the fight took place. You know, Grove's biggest asset is his length, and I would have thought that he would have kept Cote at a greater distance, but he never really seemed to do that.
Yeah, he seemed to even have trouble in the clinch.
Yeah.
He wanted to clinch up with them and throw knees to the body, and he was just having all kinds of trouble with Cote.
Yeah, he was. And really, I mean, it was ironic to me that a lot of times, Grove didn't seem to be able to reach Cote, or at least, you know, kept him at too much of a distance, and then when Cote closed the distance, he never really made him pay for it the whole time. So, I mean, Cote really, he went in there with a good game plan, you know, get away from him when you can, and then get in close when you want to attack, and it worked perfectly for him.
Yeah, Cote did a tremendous job of just controlling every single aspect of the fight. The only place where Kendall Grove was going to lose that fight was on his feet. And he decided, hey, well, let's fight stay here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So where do you see both guys going from here?
Patrick Cote is a guy that I really have never seen as a top contender. He's lost a lot of fights in the UFC. And those were to Tito Ortiz, where he was going up a weight class and took the fight on something like a few days' notice. I believe he also lost to Chris Leben, Travis Luter.
Yep.
And it's just, Cote is one of those guys that if you're not seeing Chris Leben, which the judge's decision was questionable in that fight, but if you're not pulling off a win against him, you're not a contender in the 185 division.
Yeah.
Kendall Grove, he can recover from this. He's looked very good so far. His biggest win of his career has either been over Ed Herman or Alan Belcher.
Yeah.
I think he can rebound from this, and I think he's going to come back a better fighter from it.
Yeah, I agree. I think both guys that you mentioned that Kendall Grove beat, Alan Belcher and Ed Herman, could take out Patrick Cote, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, so I think this was your proverbial wake-up call for the guy who was on top of the world and suddenly realizes, that, again, that he's not invincible. I think it's a good thing for him, you know, in the long run, to have lost this fight, because, you know, it'll be interesting to see the approach he takes next time with a guy who really only has one chance of beating him, and that's on the feet. You know, a Patrick Cote kind of fighter. So
I see a Grove fight against someone like a Chris Leben, okay, being good in the future for him.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and next we had Joe Stevenson and Kurt Pellegrino. How'd you see this one going?
Oh, I saw Stevenson winning the fight, and he did come out on top, but I really enjoyed this one. This was a great grappling match.
Yeah.
And Pellegrino is not a pushover by any means.
No, I thought he was pretty underrated coming into this fight. I thought he had a pretty good chance of pulling off the win, honestly.
Yeah, he definitely had a chance of pulling off a win. The guy's a great wrestler.
Yeah.
And I believe he was a high school state champion in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been very active on the submission grappling circuit. He competed at the Abu Dhabi tournament this past year, and he ended up losing to Marcelo Garcia in the second round of the tournament, which no shame in that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I also thought that Pellegrino's striking was a little bit underrated coming into this fight. You know, those who knew that he had good, really good ground skills, top-level Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and good wrestling as well. But I think he's also got pretty good striking, at least a little, you know, he's got a little snap on those punches. Never really was able to get a hold of Stevenson and cause a lot of damage, but he's got decent striking and probably better kicks than punches, but, you know, he was putting together some pretty decent combos.
Yeah, one of the things that it looked like happened in the fight was both guys came in with the game plan of not turning into a grappling match.
Yeah.
And started off striking.
And, yeah.
They both did good jobs of going for takedowns later on. Stevenson hit a really nice back suplex on. In the first round.
Yeah, that's what won him the first round in my book, was that nice that suplex that he had.
Yeah.
But
I had it scored 29-28, and I was giving the first round to Pellegrino.
Yeah, it was definitely close. The suplex won it for me, but I definitely I could have been talked into giving it to Pellegrino for sure. I'll ask you this: does Joe Stevenson enjoy trying to put the guillotine choke on people?
Yes, he does, and he's very vicious up too.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I like about his guillotine choke is if you watch what he does, he will put his feet on the other guy's legs and try to push his legs out as he sits back.
Yeah, you're right. I'm watching it. I have the fight on right now, actually. I'm seeing exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a very vicious way to do a choke, and some of the cross chokes in sports jiu-jitsu you can do that with, which is really adds a lot to the choke.
Yeah. It seemed that Pellegrino, a lot of what lost him the fight was his cardio.
Yeah, he seemed to tire pretty bad in the third round.
Yeah.
Not as bad as some other people later on the card, but...
Oh, for sure.
He seemed to run out of gas, I'd say, maybe mid-second round.
Yeah.
And it really took a lot out of him.
Yeah. Yeah, and this was... I think this was the first time that we'd seen Pellegrino get into the third round, because he's a guy who, in his other fights against Junior Asuncao and... or Sun Cao, however you say that, and Nate Moore, you know, they're both first-round stoppages, really quick fights.
Yeah.
We did see him, we saw him get into the third against Drew Fickett where he lost, but that was at 170. You know, it's hard to judge a lightweight when he's at 170. But those first two fights, you know, he gets out there real quick, he gets his submission, and he goes home. And, you know, I think it was probably telling for him to get into the third round because he hasn't really gone the distance a whole lot in his career. Other than against Mac Danzig, you know, way back in 2002. And that was, I think that was his only decision, if I'm not mistaken, where he did win. So yeah, I'm excited to see him again. I really enjoy his fights. Where do you see Stevenson going from here?
Rumor has it that Stevenson's going, if Sean Sharp is stripped of the title, that he will be fighting, BJ Penn for the vacant title.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing, too. What kind of chances do you give Stevenson against Penn?
Not much.
Yeah, we agree.
It's very hard for me to believe BJ Penn will ever lose to anyone.
Yeah. Yeah, 155, I mean, he's as close to unbeatable as you can get.
But, yeah, Stevenson, he's a good fighter. I don't see him as being a top lightweight contender, though.
Yeah, I think he's definitely...
below that.
Yeah, yeah, he's definitely upper tier, probably mid-upper tier, I would say. You know, it's... The lightweight division of the UFC is a lot of fun, and they've got a lot of enjoyable fighters in there. But I think it would surprise a lot of people if we got some of the Shooto guys in here. Some of the guys from K1, you know, some of those lightweights, especially guys like Shaolin, you know, bring them over into the UFC and see what happens. I think they would open up a lot of eyes in the lightweight division. And really, it would give, you know, it would give a lot of these guys a stiffer test against really top competition.
Yeah, it definitely would. I mean, guys like Takanori Gomi, Shaolin.
Yeah.
Joaquin Hansen, Calwood DeGear. I mean, they're not in the UFC right now.
Yeah. Gilbert Melendez.
Another one. Yeah, Gilbert Melendez.
Yeah. So, I mean, you would hope in the next year or so, I mean, I would at least like to see Gomi and Melendez and Kawajiri over here in the UFC. I really think that they would have a pretty good chance of signing those guys. You know, you've got three guys that fought in Pride. Melendez is with Strikeforce, but I'm pretty sure that Strikeforce is open to, you know, having open contracts. So we'll have to kind of see how that works. But Melendez would be a tremendously marketable guy to have in the lightweight division. You know, he had a 5-round fight with Clay Guida that I haven't seen, but by all indications was a pretty good fight. You know, and ended up beating Clay Guida in 5 rounds for the Strikeforce lightweight title. You know, I'd love to see him in the octagon against the BJ Penn or against the Sean Sherk. You know, any of those fights would be really intriguing.
Yeah, I actually watched that fight on Saturday right before the pay-per-view.
Oh, yeah?
And, watching it, you realize how much better Gilbert Melendez is than a guy like Clay Guida because he dominated the whole fight.
Wow.
There was one judge who was on crack that he didn't fight Guida. That's my only explanation. It had to be cracked.
Oh, man. I tell you, I don't know where some of these judges come from sometimes, you know?
Yeah, it's, I don't know what they're watching. It's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And you get a fight, speaking of Clay Guida, you get a fight like Guida Griffin. How did you see that one going?
I saw that going to Clay Guida, and
yeah.
It was a pretty easy decision to make. It was 29-28 Guida, and
yeah.
the judge completely screwed up.
Yeah, I thought so as well, and it was kind of a robbery that Griffin won that fight. Great fighter though Griffin is, real good young prospect, but he didn't win that fight. He's another guy that it would be nice to see him tested against some of these bigger names, in a year, year and a half, once he's got some more fights under his belt. Guys like Griffin and Frankie Edgar, see what they've really got once they really get going. I mean, Frankie Edgar, that's another guy. He's got, what, 5-6 fights? Something like that. Griffin himself's only got about, 9 or 10. So in a couple of years, it'd be really nice to see where these guys really are in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, and until we get all the lightweights in one promotion, we're not going to know that.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be
the assumption right now that all these other lightweights out there are better than what the UFC has, but we're actually in the cage with them. It's hard to say because look what happened to Pride Heavyweight.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean... And it is hard to say. You get a guy like Heath Herring over here who's got a great reputation, and he gets blanketed for 3 rounds. So I don't know. It is hard to say. But you got to think that these more dynamic fighters, the cage would only benefit them, especially if we can get the knees to the head passed by the commissions, which I imagine will happen. Eventually, anyway. But that was actually, speaking of me to the headed down opponent, that was something that could have helped Stevenson in this fight. I mean, he was in prime position a couple of times to deliver some knees to the head and end the fight. Had Pellegrino up against the fence and was just standing there. Pellegrino didn't want to get up because he knew he was going to eat some knees. Got to his feet and ended up eating some knees.
Yeah, you get these awkward moments where a guy shoots in on a leg, and he doesn't get it, and he just stays on the ground.
Yep. And that was another thing in the O'Brien and Herring fight that could have helped Herring. These guys with the failed sprawls, and when they're getting up and they leave themselves vulnerable, I think you'd see a lot different technique if that's something that's allowed. People are going to have to get a little more slick. A little quicker, or they're going to pay the price.
Yeah, it's... the one thing I was just thinking about now that you mentioned his name is, whatever happened to Jake O'Brien?
I don't know. I think he was rumored to... who was it that he was going to fight? I can't even remember. He was rumored to fight somebody a while back, and it never materialized. And that's a good question. I have no idea where he's been. That Herring fight was the last time we saw him, isn't it?
I believe so. I mean, he was rumored to fight Krokop for a while, and then...
Yeah, maybe that was it.
And nothing happened with that, and we haven't heard from him since.
Yeah, I wonder if he got injured or something.
I haven't heard of it.
What's that?
I haven't heard anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder if it's like a David Terrell type situation where he's just getting injured a lot. But that was, let's see, that was in January that he fought Herring. So definitely enough time to have had at least one or two more fights. So that's the question of the day. Where is Jake O'Brien? So we had Stevenson winning the fight over Pellegrino, which I think we both agree is a good decision. Stevenson looked pretty good. Pellegrino's got, he's got some more promise to get a little bit better, going to work on his cardio. But moving on to the next fight, staying in the lightweight division, we have Roger Huerta and Alberto Crane. What did you think of this one?
That was a fun fight for me.
Yeah.
I enjoyed watching Alberto Crane. He didn't have much other than jiu-jitsu that he was bringing to the table, and it hurt him in this fight quite a bit.
Yeah.
But he did a decent job and gassed in the third round. Pretty much.
Yeah, gassed badly.
He was pretty much out of it. And Warder could have finished him sometime in the second round, especially near the end, but chose to stand up and back off.
Yep.
And it really prolonged the beating that Alberto Crane received.
He did. I enjoyed this fight tremendously. I thought it was a lot of fun to watch. And you mentioned, Crane, really all he brought to the table was the jiu-jitsu. But boy, he's got some jiu-jitsu, though.
Yeah, he's got very good jiu-jitsu. And he came very close to submitting Huerta on numerous occasions.
Yeah. Yeah, had him in real trouble with had the hooks in for a choke for a while, and Huerta ended up escaping. I think this is, we talk a lot about how Huerta's been given, five UFC newcomers to get his 5-0 UFC record, but I think this was a real good fight for Huerta because he kind of was able to show off his submission defense, which turned out to be excellent.
Yeah, and that's the way you have to bring a prospect along. I mean,
yeah,
it's only been 5 fights, and boxers have 30 warm-up fights before becoming a contender.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's hard to get a perspective like that in MMA because you have so much fewer fighters in the ranks, especially in your big promotion like the UFC. You just don't have enough guys if you bring them in early in their career to get these guys so many cupcake wins. But I think you're right. This was really a way to build him up in the eyes of the fans, at least, because he's getting guys with different styles. He fought Leonard Garcia, where he's, mainly a striker, and now he's got Crane, who's a grappler. Doug Evans, who had a lot of wrestling, and beat them all. So it'll be interesting to see him against a middle-tier guy, get him a Pellegrino type or maybe a Spencer Fisher type and see how he handled those guys.
Yeah, that would definitely be interesting. And with work following and with the Latino community, I mean, that could draw as a big fan.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They're definitely riding Huerta to get into the Latino audience. I could see him headlining an event in Mexico in a couple of years easily. I know they're wanting to get into Mexico, so that's... I mean, Huerta is definitely a big key into that. So, do you see Crane back in the UFC anytime soon?
No, I really don't. I see him as, just the guy that was brought in to lose the Brock Huerta, and I really don't think that the UFC is interested in it or so one-dimensional.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Obviously very one-dimensional. Didn't really have anything to offer Huerta on the feet, and was basically dominated, even at his own game, as far as being just fended off all night. But a lot of fun to watch, as it were. So we had, what do you make of Huerta at this point as a fighter?
He's a good fighter for the level that he's on. He still needs a lot of work, though, before he's able to, someone like Shark or BJ Penn or Takanori, the best lightweights out there. He's not at that level yet. But for taking on guys that are early in their UFC careers, that's fine for him at this point. And he's going to have a lot of success doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's another thing about, a matter of perspective in the UFC lightweight division. He could end up being a real big dog here a lot sooner than he could on a worldwide stage, I think. So it makes you wonder if the UFC really has a lot of interest in bringing in these bigger names or at least these really higher caliber guys to come in and beat up all their lightweights. I think that's the question that we have to wonder about.
I think they are. It's just that they are having trouble signing them. I heard that they just offered Manson a contract, which was for decent money, and he turned it down.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. Because it's, you know, it's disappointing when that kind of thing happens, because you really, you know, talk about competition of promotions and all that all you want to, but, you know, you want to see all the guys in one promotion. You want to see all your bigger fighters under the same banner, because you want to see those big fights. You know, I want to see Sean Sherk take on Takanori Gomi when Sherk gets on a roll like he has been, and see if he's really up to that level to take on a guy of Gomi's size. You know, I want to see Kawajiri come in here and take on, you know, BJ Penn. You know, I want to see those fights. So hopefully we can make that kind of thing happen, or Dana White can make that kind of thing happen. Moving on, we had George St. Pierre and Josh Koscheck. What was your take on this one?
The fight pretty much played out how I expected. And that was with St. Pierre dominating the whole thing.
Yeah.
It was rather tempting, though, with 2-1 odds to say, like, hey, Koscheck's a good bet here, but Pierre's just way more experienced than him. And was coming off a loss, so he was going to be hungry into this fight.
Yeah.
Pierre was able to take Josh Koscheck down. He was able to take down Frank Trigg. He was able to take down Sean Sherk. And most people don't realize this, but Josh Koscheck is not the best takedown defense in the world. I've seen wrestlers that were a little fraction as good as him take him down in a match. Koscheck has stopped coming back and winning, but, you know, their bank have gotten first to that one.
Yeah, I think if I was going to be surprised by anything, it was going to be if Koscheck couldn't take St. Pierre down, because of his, he just had such, you know, explosive takedowns, as they say. You know, he really has that hip movement that he just, you know, lifts guys up and drives right through them, as Joe Rogan is fond of saying. But, you know, he was able to do it once, but that was all. I mean, you know, St. Pierre, you remember when he fought Sherk, he shrugged Sean Sherk off like he wasn't even there. You know, and it was, that was what I wanted to see, is if Koscheck could actually take him down, which he ended up doing it once, but it wasn't easy. You know, I mean, even for a top-level wrestler like Koscheck. So I think St. Pierre has probably answered all the questions about how he does against wrestlers with his list of opponents that he's gone through. I mean, coming into this fight, you know, you gotta look at, like you said, the experience. I mean, George St. Pierre has fought just a murderer's row of opponents and beaten all of them, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you Carl Parisian, Jay Heron, Matt Hughes, Jason Miller, Frank Trigg, Sean Sherk, BJ Penn, all of them. He's beaten them all, you know. And Koscheck, he's got a win over Diego Sanchez that wasn't really a win, you know. So, I mean, coming into this fight, I don't know how you pick Koscheck, really. I mean, obviously anybody's got a chance to win a fight, but like you said, St. Pierre was hungry, and he's got the pedigree of a champion. So, I mean, I saw the fight going shorter than it did. I thought St. Pierre was going to knock him out, but give Koscheck a lot of credit. You know, I think he's finally won me over. I had him pegged as a wrestler who had okay everything else, but he hung in there with St. Pierre, which is impressive.
Yeah, I think the highlight of the night for me, other than the main event, was Mike Goldberg's line that the crowd seems to love St. Pierre, and then he adds, not that they don't love Josh Koscheck.
Who got booed the entire way from the back to the ring.
Well, I live about 45 minutes from Koscheck's hometown.
Yeah.
They don't like him there very much either.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's good. I mean, you know, Koscheck.
One guy watching the pay-per-view with me went to college with Josh Koscheck, and he's not a fan of him.
Oh, you know, it's funny because, I mean, obviously, and Koscheck seems like a guy that's used to it. He fits right into the role of kind of the villain, you know. and he seems to like it.
Yeah, and it's funny because I know a lot of people that know Kasha through wrestling, and no one really claims that, hey, I used to be friends with this guy.
Yeah, very interesting. So where do you see, you've got Sarah and you've got Hughes coming up in November, December-ish for the welterweight title. And then you've got St. Pierre getting the piece of the champ after that. What do you see unfolding in those two fights?
As much as I hate to say it, I see Matt Hughes defeating Matt Sarah in, I believe, December, and giving us the third George St. Pierre-Matt Hughes match, with St. Pierre coming out on top there.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I don't know if the third St. Pierre Hughes match is going to go quite like the second did, but I think the outcome will be pretty much the same. I don't think Hughes has a whole lot for St. Pierre at this point. I don't think anyone really has a lot for St. Pierre right now. I think he's the best welterweight in the world to me, who just got caught. All the credit in the world to Matt Serra. But St. Pierre wins that fight 9 times out of 10.
And I think that Matt Hughes is actually a better opponent for George St. Pierre than Matt Serra.
Yeah, because of the striking.
Well, not only because of the striking. George St. Pierre doesn't seem to fully understand the submission game yet.
Yeah.
The submission he got caught in by Matt Hughes, he pretty much had his own chance of getting an arm part there, and he completely missed it.
Yeah.
Okay, it was a race to see who caught the other one with their knee first and locked in an arm bar. And they made a mistake there due to the mistake of not blocking St. Pierre's knee as he moved around, and St. Pierre made the mistake of going for the Kimura from half guard.
Yep. Yeah, and he eventually did get his leg over the head in the Koscheck fight and pulled him, tried to pull that off, but it was funny when Koscheck was defending and holding on to his shorts, and the
St. Pierre and St. Pierre not understanding the submission yet. He was trying to pull the arm up. In order to get that submission, what you have to do is you have to pull the arm away from the body.
Yeah.
And then jam it up.
Yeah, I think he mentioned. Go ahead.
It was just poor technique on his part, and he could have got that submission if he was doing that kick.
Yeah. It's now that you mentioned, I think he mentioned after the fight that Greg Jackson told him how to do that after the fight was over. Taught him how to pull that submission off from there when a guy's holding on to his shorts. So he's I think his association with Greg Jackson's camp has just made him a lot more dangerous to the welterweight division than he was before, and he was extremely dangerous before. So it's not going to be a good time for anybody getting in there with St. Pierre in the near future.
Yeah, he's going to be very tough to beat from here on out.
Yeah. The grab of the shorts was kind of a comical moment. It seemed like neither St. Pierre nor the ref really knew what to do about it. was saying, let go of your shorts. But that was
illegal to grab onto your own shorts.
Yeah, that was the thing. I think he really didn't know. St. Pierre was kind of throwing his arms out, saying, "What do I do here?" Looking at the ref, and the ref's like, "I can't really do anything about it." So he just kind of let it go. They were in that position for a good 2 minutes.
It's a common thing in sports jiu-jitsu that guys will defend by grabbing onto their own gi, and that's one of the things with training with a gi that you learn how to work around it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, because that was, that's true. I remember, especially in the early UFCs when you got Royce Gracie using the gi to his advantage quite often, actually, with the chokes and things like that. So it's certainly not something that's foreign to submission grappling, as you say. But I thought I had a real good time watching this fight as well. I had it down as the fight of the night. Really enjoyed it. You know, St. Pierre putting on a clinic, and Koscheck really weathering a lot. Although being dominated, it was still a lot of fun to watch for me. Although I do have to mention, we didn't get to this in the Huerta fight. The part where Huerta was looking up at the screen and throwing back elbows, I thought that was tremendous.
Yeah, that was just really cool.
Yeah. I mean, that shows you the kind of cerebral fighter that Huerta is, you know. Seems like a real smart guy, and, you know, you use whatever you can use to get your advantage. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
But speaking of smart fighters, main event, heavyweight champ, Randy Couture, taking on Gabe Gonzaga. What do you got here?
Randy's just amazing. He came in there with a great game plan and executed it perfectly. And yep. I don't know if he can be better than perfect, but I think he was. I don't think he planned to break Gonzaga's nose with that slam.
Right. Yep. Yeah, and, you know, we both had Couture winning that fight, which shows, you know, how much smarter than we are. How much smarter we are than most people, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, Couture, you can't, I don't know how you plan to fight Couture, because he comes out and he does something different every time. You know, whether it's taking a guy down, whether it's getting him in the clinch, whether it's closing the distance or keeping him away, he does whatever he needs to do to win the fight, and he does it better than the other guy every time. You know, it just seems like he's getting better. I mean, whoever heard of, you know, outside Barry Bonds with steroids, who's getting better like Randy Couture is in his mid-40s? You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, the only other guy I can think of is maybe George Blanda in the NFL.
Yeah, which was years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, Couture, I mean, Couture is just... he's a specimen that you don't come across very often, but yeah, just I think we're real lucky to be able to watch a guy like him in this generation. What do you see with Gabe Gonzaga in the future?
Gabe Gonzaga, he's one of those guys that you never really expect to make it this far, especially after the first time that he saw him, he's been in the UFC. I forget who he fought, but Kevin Jordan. It was a horrible fight.
Yeah.
Okay. Watched his fight against Verdum, where he completely gassed. Well, both completely gassed.
Yeah. that fight was actually a little bit comical.
Yeah. And never expected that. Hey, this guy's going to eat a title on one of the biggest stages in MMA.
Yeah.
He made it there, so, you know, I expect some big things from Jay Gonzaga in the future. But...
Yeah, I do too. I think in a couple more years, I mean, you're talking about a guy who's 8-2, you know. He's got 10 fights after fighting Couture. I think this will be a tremendous learning experience for him. You know, I mean, even in that Kevin Jordan fight, and this was, you know, he was having a lot of personal things going on. I think his daughter had just, you know, he had a baby that just died before that fight. But, you know, even in that fight, he ends the fight with a Superman punch that just was huge. I mean, you know, knocked out Jordan's teeth in the fight. And, you know, and this is a guy that's a submission guy, you know. He's a jiu-jitsu guy. But he's just got such power in those hands and those feet. You know, he knocks out Krokop, which, you know, Krokop can get caught, but that head kick was no fluke, you know.
He has a very wicked head kick.
Yeah, real nasty. And speaking of head kicks, when he caught Couture, I mean, he caught Couture pretty flush with that head kick, and Couture just shrugged it off. I mean, that was insane.
Yeah, it was one of those things that, you know, throughout the fight, I was nervous that Couture could get knocked out at any time. And, you know, every time Gonzaga lifted his leg, it was, really slow, the fight can end here.
Yeah, and even the punches. I mean, anytime Couture got far enough away for Gonzaga to punch, there was the chance that he was going to knock him out. I mean, he's got tremendous power in those fists. And, you know, you saw all it took was Couture taking a couple of punches, and he was like, I'm getting back in the clinch.
Yeah, and the one thing about Randy, though, is he got the best clinch in MMA.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Austin from the clinch is just amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you see guys, you know, a lot of guys use the clinch more as a stall or as a way to get into some kind of position for a takedown. But Couture just does such damage from the clinch and gets those slams like he got that broke Gonzaga's nose. I mean, it's like he uses that to get wherever he wants to go.
Yeah, it's the other interesting aspect of the fight that I thought was during the second round when Gonzaga called a timeout.
Yeah. Yeah. He pulled a John Fitch. Called a timeout.
Okay. Why hasn't anyone else ever thought of that?
You know, it reminded me at first of, you know, the Chuck Liddell-Jeremy Horn fight. When Horn couldn't see, when he told Big John, I can't see, the fight was over.
Yeah.
But I think, I don't know whether it was the language barrier that got in the way here, or whether Gonzaga didn't understand the rules, or whether he did understand the rules and just pulled off a really slick timeout maneuver. But, you know, I think it just confused Herb Dean a little bit, who's normally really, really good at what he does. And I think, you know, I like that he restarted them in the same position that they were in before. But really, the fight should have been over at that point if he couldn't see.
Yeah. The one thing I do think that Herb Dean made the right call on was, you know, it may have been because of the language barrier.
Yeah.
That Gonzaga didn't understand the rules.
Yeah.
But it's something that you watch and you think, okay, someone else should try to call a timeout, you know.
Yeah.
Your fighter should try to take a point away from his opponent.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, maybe it's something that they'll address more closely now in the pre-fight discussions because they go back there and they talk about the rules. You know, maybe that's something that they'll mention now. If at any time you need blood cleaned up so that you can fight, you know, the fight's over. Because, you know, I think really Gonzaga just wanted to have, if he didn't understand the rule, you know, he just wanted to have the blood get out of his eyes, which is understandable. But, you know, I mean, that's just how it goes.
Yeah. And, what do you think the backlash would have been this week if Gonzaga would have ended up winning the fight after that?
Oh wow, that's a good question. I don't know. It wouldn't have been pretty for sure. You know, at least in our area of the MMA media, you know, the message boards would have lit up and Dana White would have made fun of everybody and you know, it wouldn't have been pretty for sure. At least in the MMA world.
Yeah.
Which really, what other world matters?
Yeah, it's, I mean, Dana would have been, you know, calling a whole lot of people fat then.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure. Oh. Yeah. So, but it ended up with Couture winning. You know, the broken nose sure did play a part in it, but it wasn't, you know, obviously wasn't something that was intentional. Or, you know, malicious on Couture's part. But it happens in fights. You know, it happened against Joe Stevenson. Joe Stevenson broke his nose earlier in the night. And actually came out that Couture had his arm broken, blocking one of those head kicks.
Yeah, I heard that. And it doesn't look like we're going to be seeing Randy fight for a while.
Yeah, until the end of the year, or until next year anyway. It sounds like February at the earliest. Which is probably disappointing to the UFC because I think they probably wanted to get him on that December card.
Yeah, I think they wanted to, but I think they realized with him shooting a movie in October that it would be pretty hard to get him in December.
Yeah, and for those who haven't heard, he's shooting a movie, as Mike mentioned, prequel to The Scorpion King, where he's going to play, I think, the enemy to The Scorpion King, whoever is playing that. It's not The Rock this time, somebody else. But anyway, all that's on side notes. Couture looks like he'll be back in February or so. and the pre-event rumblings are that his opponent could be Nogueira. Now, I will say this. If the UFC somehow is able to sign Fedor between now and then, I've got to see that fight, and I think I'm not the only one. I think Couture actually is wanting to fight Fedor, which is understandable. You know, who knows how many fights he has left in him. Though at this point, I wouldn't be surprised to see him out there when he's 60, you know. But Couture does want Fedor. Dana White wants to get Fedor in the UFC. I think everybody wants to see that fight. How would you see that fight going? Who would you have winning that fight?
You have to go with Fedor.
Yeah.
And the guy's just too young, too strong. His submissions are great. His ground and pound is great. He's got good takedown ability and very good stand-up, too. I mean, the guy doesn't seem to have any faults.
Yeah, I think that's the thing with Fedor. I would favor Couture against pretty much any other heavyweight. I think he beats Nogueira. I think he beats Krokop even easier than Nogueira. I think he beats Barnett if they fight again. But I don't see him beating Fedor. I mean, and if Jerry was on the call, he would be hollering at us right now. But I think Fedor, it's like you say. I mean, this is a guy. Fedor has fought 27 times, and really, he's never lost. I mean, he lost the one fight to Yoshiko Osaka on a cut, 17 seconds into the first round. But you know, that's not really a loss. Plus, he came back and pounded Osaka later on. So you know, Fedor, he's the most dominant fighter in MMA history. I mean, there's no way around that.
Yeah, he's something else, okay? It's like the guy's not human. Kevin Randleman drops him on his head.
Yeah.
And 15 seconds later, he submits him.
Yeah. And I think that's the mark of a great fighter because, you know, the great fighters aren't the guys that go through and mow everybody down in their path. The great fighters are the ones that get in trouble, get hurt, you know, get beat up, and come back and win. You know, and that's what Fedor has done. He's been in trouble numerous times, you know, and he just never loses.
Yeah, the other way to measure a great fighter is someone like Randy that just goes out there and, you know, steals the heart of his opponent.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, Gonzaga was out of that fight. I mean, the broken bones played a part in it, but when he was hitting Randy and couldn't get into a rhythm, and Randy would close the distance every time he would start throwing some strikes, he was done. I mean, he couldn't didn't recover from that.
Yeah, an MMA fight is a lot more than brawling. Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
It's going out there, recognizing the game plan of your opponent, and stuffing it.
Yeah, I mean, you look at that Tim Sylvia fight. That's a classic example of Couture game planning and imposing his will throughout that whole entire fight. I mean, Sylvia was out of the fight in the first round. The fight was over.
I think the big question, even more than Randy Fedor, is if they fought again, who would win? Your Rico Rodriguez.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And would Rico be able to make 265?
Would he gas on the way to the cage? That would be the question for Rico. That's the one. If there's one big fight left in Randy's career, I think he wants it to be Fedor. And I hope that happens. I mean, that's, even more than Liddell Silva, which we'll get to see now, hopefully, I want to see that one. I mean, while Couture is still youthful.
Yeah, the other fight I'd really like to see is Randy against Josh Barnett.
Yeah, that is true. That's a close second for me is Couture Barnett, because Barnett actually called out Couture the other day. I think he was it was in some interview somewhere where he's saying that no one ever beat him in the cage for the title and all that stuff. So. And, called Couture basically a paper champion, which, you know, if he's trying to get into the UFC and trying to make a money fight, I think there's, you know, if the UFC signs Josh Barnett, Josh Barnett is an easy guy to market. He markets himself.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that would be real interesting. And I think they will. I think Barnett will eventually go to the UFC because it'll probably depend. I mean, his immediate future probably depends on Fedor. I think he wants Fedor. And he's probably going to follow him wherever he goes, maybe for a one-fight deal, and then I see him coming to the UFC. At least I hope that's how it goes. And, of course, hopefully the UFC gets Fedor and we can see these fights, you know, without having to go from promotion to promotion. That's how I see Barnett going.
Yeah, Josh Barnett would do a great job of vilifying himself for the crowd.
Oh, absolutely.
In order to make this into a huge fight.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about Barnett is he could vilify himself with a crowd, and then two events later, he could be a fan favorite.
Yeah, and I don't know if you noticed after the Babalu fight, Barnett his big shit-eating grin on his face.
Yes.
Clapping, wow.
Back there applauding, yeah. I did notice that.
I think he was the only one in the building applauding Babalu at that point.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So that's, Barnett is, he's a great character. I'd love to see him more often. I think that's your big picture in the UFC heavyweight chapter, or, you know, division right now, is Couture and the two guys that they need to get, Barnett and Fedor. Nogueira, Krokop, they're up there as well. Gonzaga's up there now. Until we see Barnett and Fedor, I should say, once we see Barnett and Fedor in the UFC, then the heavyweight picture is complete. We've got everybody in the same place, you know. Unless I'm missing somebody.
Andre Arlovski is someone that has to be considered up there.
Oh, yeah. I just mean outside of the UFC. I mean, when they get those two, it's pretty much complete with all the UFC heavyweight guys. But Arlovski, where has he been?
They haven't put him in any fights since the Fabricio Verdum fight that they found to be very boring.
Yeah, and I don't get that because, you know, I mean, it's fine that he did what he had to do to win the fight. You know, everybody does that from time to time. Arlovski, it doesn't matter what Arlovski does. The fans love him. I mean, when you've got a guy like that, and he didn't hurt himself at UFC 70, you book him again. Book him against the guy that he can beat. You know, book him against the guy that he'll look good against, that he knows that he can beat. He'll come out there and pound him, you know. But get him back out there. I mean, he's such an entertaining guy to watch. When he's on his game, I just don't see how the UFC isn't capitalizing on that.
Yeah, he's definitely a fighter that the crowd will pay money to see, and especially if it's up against the right opponent.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully we'll see him back soon. You know, I think a great fight is Arlovski Krokop. I mean, what an entertaining fight that would be. You kidding me?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, hopefully we get to see something like that. I mean, it'd certainly be better than Krokop and Congo. I mean, Congo's got some good stand-up. Actually, I mean, that fight's not going to the ground. Let's not be silly here. So that could be an entertaining fight in itself, but Arlovski would be a better opponent for him at this point. But, oh well, that's just us, right?
Well, what I've seen of Congo's groundwork, Krokop's best game plan would be take him to the ground.
Yeah, no kidding. If you hung with Fedor on the ground for three rounds, I think you could probably take out Congo.
Yeah.
Although, what kind of surreal sight would it be to see Krokop going in for a takedown?
Yeah, that would be strange.
So, well, that pretty much wraps up the event. Do you have any final thoughts on the event as a whole?
Yeah, I thought it was a great show. Not much to complain about. We had some very good lightweight matches, and the upset of Kendall Grove in the fight with Patrick Cote, and a very inspiring main event with Randy Couture.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I have it down as the event of the year, surpassing UFC 71 a little bit. There was nothing on the show that was unenjoyable. The pacing was really good. They did a real good job of getting everything in there. You know, I mean, this is contrasting this one with UFC 73. I think the producers of these pay-per-views really learned a lesson with 73, where they almost didn't get five fights in the last time, and this time they got six in, with three of them going into the third round, and two of them going the distance, and that's not something that they would usually do.
Yeah, the pacing on UFC 73 was really bad.
Yeah, it was horrible.
There's been some people arguing out there that the number one contender fight should be five-round fights, but I have a feeling that if the UFC ever goes to that, they're going to have a lot of trouble with their pacing.
Yeah, I agree. And, I don't think that they should be five rounds. MMA is not boxing. I think, you've got your time frame, work within it. That's part of the game, and keep those title fights at five rounds. If you move a number one contender fight to five rounds, then you've got to move your title fights to seven, or maybe you don't have to, but I don't know. I just like to keep it 3 and 5 myself.
Yeah, and do we really want to see Diego Sanchez and Josh Koscheck?
For two more rounds.
Yeah. Was it April?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And do you want to see Arlovski Sylvia 3 for seven rounds?
Definitely not.
you just don't need it. For every great five-round number one contender fight, you'll have a terrible seven-round title fight, and that's a terrible five-round number one contender fight. It's give and take, and I think that the system that they have right now with the rounds is good. I think the scoring system is messed up, but the round system they have in place right now is just fine. It's not broke to me.
No, it's not.
Yeah. So we've got, great event here. They're gonna have a hard time following up. I shouldn't say that now. We've got UFC 75 coming up next Saturday night. Looks to be a real good card, and it's a free card. They could do a lot of good with this card on free TV. The Quentin Jackson Dan Henderson fight, that could be real exciting.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that one, and I think it's going to be rather reminiscent of the Quentin Jackson Matt Lindland fight, which on the WFA pay-per-view last year was a great fight.
Yeah, real good fight. Real good fight. A lot of people had Matt Lindland winning that fight. I thought Rampage took it myself, but good fight. So we've got that one, and I think they got some really good main card fights on here. We've got the Krokop Kongo fight, which should be a crowd pleaser. That one's not going the distance. Bisping Hamill, I don't know how that one's going to go.
Don't be surprised if Matt Hamill wins this one.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know. I don't know if Bisping has the wrestling deal with Hamill. I can see a Jake O'Brien, Heath Herring kind of thing going on here.
Yeah, Bisping has never really impressed me on the ground. Hamill's never really impressed me on his feet.
Yeah. And when you get a battle of guys who, one's great on the ground, one's great on the feet, the ground guy usually ends up winning. At least if the guy on the feet doesn't have really good takedown defense, and I don't know if Bisping has really been tested in that area.
Nah, he really hasn't yet.
Yeah. So we've got that one, which, could go either way. Then you've got Houston Alexander and Alessio Zaccaro, which has no choice but to be exciting. I think that's another crowd pleaser. And Paul Taylor and Marcus Davis as your swing fight, which I think could be a sleeper for fight of the night.
Yeah, Marcus Davis has really impressed me lately. I did not expect things on the Ultimate Fighter ever
yeah.
really doing much in the UFC, and he's really come on strong.
Yeah. I mean, that's your classic one-dimensional fighter, as he started out. And now he's come back and he's showing some really impressive submission skills.
Yeah.
For as short a time as he's been doing it.
Yeah, he's been training out in Cincinnati with George Gurgel and Rich Franklin, and
yeah,
it seems like he's picking up quite a bit out there.
Yeah. Could be another late bloomer, another guy who seems to be a natural. But we will see. Time will tell. That welterweight division is tough to crack, man. It's tough to get into that upper echelon right now. But
Davis, yeah, especially with most of the welterweight fighters in the UFC.
Yeah, exactly. You never really had a welterweight division in Pride, and you see what that led to in the UFC. I mean, that's the deepest, that's the most top-heavy division in all of MMA right now.
Yeah, I would have to agree.
Yeah. And we'll get to see, we got some prelims on that card as well. We'll get to see Thiago Silva hopefully go a little bit longer than he did against James Irvin, where Irvin completely messed up his knee, which you know a little something about. We'll get the return of Anthony Torres. I don't know who was calling for that, but we'll get to see how that goes. Terry Adams is going to come back. All these guys that we saw in UFC 70, who put on a really good show. We'll see how all these guys shape up. Should be a real good card. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and it's free.
Yeah, you can't beat that. And actually, I should mention, we have two free cards next week. We got the WEC coming up next Wednesday.
Is Art of War free, or is that on pay-per-view?
Art of War is on pay-per-view.
Okay.
But that's another one coming up. You got Art of War, you got Elite XC coming up the week after that. You got Cage Rage coming up. You know, your IFL championships are coming up. K1 Heroes is coming up. Just crazy, you know. September is just a huge month.
Strikeforce at the end of the month?
Strikeforce at the end of the month, yeah. I mean, I remember back in June we were talking about how big June was, but, man, September is looking to be bigger. I mean, it's just crazy how all this stuff is falling. And that WEC card that we mentioned, you've got two title fights on that one. You've got your bantamweight and your lightweight title fights. I think the Rob McCullough, Rich Conkleton fight could be a good one.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really looking forward to that.
The
show's kind of lost a fight on it with Jens Pulver getting hurt and being out with his and the fight with Cub Swanson being canceled.
Yeah, that's a real intriguing fight to me too, because I enjoy Cub Swanson. I think he'd give Pulver a really good fight.
Yeah, he's a very aggressive fighter.
Yeah.
And, he could have some trouble if Pulver would, go on the counterattack, but it could have been a really interesting fight.
Yeah. So hopefully that fight will still happen, maybe when Pulver's back in action. But that could happen. We've still got lots to talk about. We'll hit on we'll do our UFC 75 preview next week, the official one. We'll talk a little bit about the WEC event once that's over. And we've got fight night. We got the next fight night coming up the week after that. All sorts of stuff going on here at MMA Torch. In the meantime, join us on the forums. Give us some feedback on the show. Any columns that you enjoy, anything you're not enjoying, you think we're idiots, tell us that too. Mike, any parting shots?
Any parting shots? I'm going to be in Niles, Ohio on September 15th, cornering John Ofer as he takes on Kevin Zelak at the IFBL show. So if you're in the West Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio area, make sure to get out there and check it out.
Excellent. Be sure and check that out. I'm hoping that MMA scene takes off on the East Coast. That's where I'm from. I think it's, I mean, all it's going to take is Pennsylvania passing the letting MMA through, and I think we're going to see events in Philly and Pittsburgh. In no time, we've already got Cincinnati and Columbus, which, you know, Columbus was a huge venue. Cincinnati is going to be great. You and I are going to be there, so that's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
And have you heard anything about Pennsylvania? Was there any closer to legalizing?
Well, it's been legalized. They haven't decided on rules yet.
There you go. See, I'm behind the times.
Yeah, based on how long it took them to decide on who was going to get the gambling licenses, we should see MMA here in about 8 years.
Gotta love bureaucracy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Pennsylvania has the worst for state guns.
Well, maybe we can get some of my old stomping grounds in Delaware. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
We might not have...
The big one in the East Coast is going to be getting New York involved.
Oh, for sure. Once New York and Chicago and Detroit are on board, I think it's all downhill from there. Philly and Pittsburgh can't be far behind at that point. They're going to be missing out. So hopefully that takes off. So, for Mike Jarzlik, this is Sean Edis. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.